C1SP. Number 11A.
I wanted to read that statement from Mrs. Eddy. The notebook says that she said, "I cannot produce sickness. I experimented one time. A student went into another room, and I argued sickness for him as hard as I could. He said he kept feeling better and better." "Then he argued for me, and I began to feel pain right away. I'm working now to overcome sin and not feel others' thoughts. You can see by the above, I cannot be a malpractitioner. I feel others' thoughts mentally, but I'm trying to work out of that. I do not want to feel them." So you see what again what she says in this respect. She says that she could think sickness, but the patient could get well. Why? Because she can't be a malpractitioner, because her whole attitude, not only just her thinking, her whole attitude was already so much imbued. Imbued, that's a very nice term, imbued by the divine mind, that she could say or think otherwise, but that divine mind would always heal. On the other hand, she acknowledges that she still can be under the influence of mortal mind directed towards her, but she says that shouldn't be, and that she says, "I'm working now out of sin." You see, that it's really sin when we attack mentally somebody, because one day we will rise to that point where no evil influence will, either knowingly or unknowingly, intentionally or unintentionally, will be able to reach us. So let's see also out of this instance that it is really, first of all, the attitude in which we are which matters, because Mrs. Eddy was imbued with that attitude of the mind of Christ. She could not do any more evil to somebody else, no matter what she said or thought about it. You know, I didn't find where somewhere Mr. Dorley has said that quite distinctly, and I remember him saying it personally quite often, but I couldn't find at the moment where he writes about it. But perhaps you remember that so often he said, "Well, it is our whole spiritual mentality and attitude which heals the sick." And no matter what you tell the patient, you can tell to the patient, "Go to hell," and he gets well, if your whole mental attitude is imbued with the mind of Christ. See, that really shows, you see, that it isn't a good belief which heals. It must be the divine mind, which is the basis, which is reality, and which is truth. And then it doesn't matter what the mouth says, what the tongue speaks. That doesn't matter anymore. And we arrive at that point where it not even matters what the brain thinks, because neither the brain is neither a mesmerist nor is he a healer. The brain isn't God, and the brain isn't divine mind. That's what she brings out here in this first subject. It gives a holy atmosphere, a holy touch, a touch of sanctity really to that whole subject of Christian Science, which says, oh, Christian Science isn't just a mental practice, because mentality can be a mentality springing from brain and beliefs. What it is mind. The mind, the mind, the divine mind, the mind of Christ. That is what is necessary. Then we go to the second subject of spirit. And in this second subject of spirit, I think she wants to say this. She again compares Christian Science with spiritualism. And she shows here that all the strength and force of spiritualism lies in mysticism. That all the phenomena which are expressions of power and of force and of strength, that they are phenomena which spring from mysticism, not from God. Whereas in Christian Science, the strength must come from the mind science, from the mind of Christ. That strength which comes from the mind of Christ is the real force and it's the real power. And that strength really comes from the apprehension of truth. That the more we apprehend and understand truth, the more we express strength, which is real strength. The more we express and experience power, which is real power. Whereas spiritualism gives phenomena of power, like table tipping, table rapping, table lifting, table turning, and so on. Quite a lot of it, you see, which again express a physical phenomena expressing that there is somewhere a force and called the force of spirits. Here must a reason be given to that. We just can't resort to mysticism and says there are some spirits somewhere and I think they're departed, they have a jolly good time with us one evening and have some table tipping and some table lifting and some this and that. But that we see that it is in mortal mind, that the mysticism must be lifted and there must be an explication, and the explication lies within the explication that mortal mind is a force, just as electricity is a force, just as explosion motor, how you call it, combustion, yes, is expressing power. As electricity is expressing power, so mortal mind is expressing power. Mortal volition is expressing power. She compares that very nicely and says, well, what is more mysterious? If mortal mind lifts my hand, well, who is going to lift that weight? What is it that makes that hand lift, move? Says, well, it's the volition of the human mind. It's not, we can't say it's just mind, with small n, because I can say, all right, I'm going to lift my hand and it drops down, because my volition is that it drops down, it does not lift up. There must be coupled with it the volition of the human mind. And so, just as there is individual volition of mortal mind, so there is a whole universal volition of mortal mind, a traditional volition of mortal mind, a mystic volition of mortal mind, and all these things, which all express that it is just as easy for mortal mind to lift the table without touching it with the hands, just as it is that we can lift an arm through mortal mind volition. That's her explanation, and we find that over and over in various systems of mind, so-called mind systems all over the world. I remember of recent date, which always gave me quite a kick. Some friends of mine were in India a few years ago, and just by chance they came to a place where one of these holy masters or whatever they were called had died years and years ago, and on that place was laid a big stone which no man could move by himself with all his force. It was about 200 or 250 pounds. And the belief there was that if, I can't remember if there were 11 or 13 people standing around that stone and just touching everyone just slightly with the finger and calling out the name of that holy master that died there, shouting it as loud as they can, just like the prophets of Baal, that the enormous stone began to lift itself to the height of about a meter and stayed there and then afterwards dropped down. And that could be done by anybody, by Europeans and so on, though when the natives did it, it worked a bit better, but not there was not, in principle, not a difference. So all these things, like what happens in spiritualistic meetings, where actually you can see how the table lifts itself, where you can see how a table or a stool begins to tap without that you move it. It taps like wild, tack, 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 you know, and so on, or that it lifts, or that the vase is put from one place to the other without any trick and so on. That's mortal mind moving matter. And she all concludes and brings it back to that very simple statement at the end of that paragraph, where she says, this belief rests on the common conviction. See, she says, on a common conviction, not only on the spiritualistic conviction, on the common conviction that mind and matter cooperate. That's that thousand, million-year-old belief. Because all, through all the millions of years, everyone believed in the cooperation of mind, small m, with matter. Because we all believe in them, we have all those classifications of that belief. Be it that we set the table every morning and every day, every afternoon and every evening and set the table, so mortal man can also lift and set and move a table. It's only, the difference is only the difference in belief. And if we are educated like the Easterners, or if we are trained like a good medium through years and years of good training into that belief that the table moves without touching it with the hand, then we educate a belief in a certain direction and therefore can give the phenomena in that way. But if we if we don't train ourselves in that way, we can't do it. I'm quite sure that I could talk to this table as long as I would. It wouldn't move for an inch not for an inch. But I'm sure that a good medium could make it move. I'm not trained in it. I don't believe in it. I have no pleasure in it. I have no... My whole attitude doesn't go into that direction. But I certainly can lift my hand with mind. And you can... And so there is not much difference between these two categories. She speaks here that it is mortal mind which convulses its substratum, matter, and that these movements arise from the volition of human belief. But they are neither scientific nor rational. See, it always comes back to this point. It always comes back to the point where we should not be satisfied just by seeing that there are phenomena which are unusual to us. Something which departs from the common conviction that mind moves matter and goes into the uncommon conviction that mind moves matter. When it goes into the uncommon, we shouldn't begin to think there is something supernatural about it. I think there must be something divine about it. I think there must be something immortal and spiritual about it. See, there we make the mistake. But we should just classify as what it is, that it does not come from the divine mind, and therefore it's not scientific and not rational. It's no savior. It is no savior. We can't save ourselves through a belief that mortal mind, volition, moves matter. On the contrary, that is just the devil. Because if mortal mind can move certain poison or what you call bacteria, can move it to the wrong place through hate, through jealousy, through anything, well, and produce a sickness and so on, I don't think it is phenomenal. I don't think it's divine. I think it's the devil. It's not the Christ. So let's see that we always make that nice, clear-cut distinction between the divine mind doing something and between either common belief or uncommon belief doing something. It's in every case, it is unusual. She speaks here of that French toy Planchette. I don't know if you know that. It was en vogue, so round about, at the end of the last century. It was I tell you what it was here in English. Webster says it was a small, usually heart-shaped board supported on casters at two points and on a vertical pencil at the third. It is said that when the fingers of one or more person are lightly rested on the board, it sometimes moves without conscious volition or effort of the operator, so that the pencil point traces words or sentences. And that was a toy which was quite common. And naturally, the spiritualistic belief is everywhere that if somebody is susceptible to spiritualistic communication, that the spirits lead the hand of the medium and writes all sorts of things in a writing which is not the writing of the medium, but in another writing, in the writing of the spirit, naturally, of that belief. Well, it all seems mysterious if one doesn't see that mortal mind is mortal mind, and a mortal belief is mortal belief. And as we will see then in the fourth subject, that mind readers and mediums can reproduce these beliefs. Just as we can reproduce the picture of a dear friend who has passed away years and years ago. Or just as we can close our eyes and see the face of a dear friend who lives on the other side of the globe. We can do that very easily. Well, if we are trained and susceptible to mortal mind and to mortal belief, we can do some other phenomena. But it's all the same. It's all the same stuff. It's all mortal mind stuff. And the point where we can make the big mistake is to call it supernatural, instead of calling it a phase of mortal belief. Phase of mortal belief. Then, let's go on to soul. To the third. Here, in the third, she wants to bring out that in spiritualism, the immortality of man is a mere assertion, not the proof. Whereas in Christian Science, man's immortality is the logical consequence of the immortality of God. Now, you see, here we touch something very important. Spiritualists say we can prove the immortality of man because spirits come back and to us. And so it shows that after death there is a life. There is life after death, or the spirits couldn't come back. Well, there is no proof that spirits come back, but as we have seen, that all that is that the crucial point really is not persons, but the belief behind the person. That we must go to the origin of everything. we can see, well, there always existed a belief in immortality. All through the thousands of years and through all cultures, in one way or the other, there always existed a belief of immortality. And that belief is a proof, is not scientific. Whereas what we try to see is that if we start from the origin of everything, which is God, and if we see that God is soul, and therefore they're always God, and never anything but God, then we can see the immortality of God. But the moment we have the immortality of God, we have the immortality of His creation. So our proof of immortality does not rest on some communication from a departed mortal spirit, from a departed person, from the oracle of a spirit. Our proof rests on a scientific deduction. We resort to science to prove something and not to a person to prove something. Just as in mathematics, we don't resort to a man or to a woman, to a person, to prove mathematics. We go to the principle of mathematics to prove the mathematics. And we don't care if that person is young or old or so who explains it and so on. We go to the principle. If the principle is right, we don't care about the person. So, also in science, our proof that there is immortality would be a very poor proof if it would have to rest on a communication of a mortal who has passed on. And perhaps after having passed on is not much further spiritually than when he was here. But, and, so here I think she gives one of the cleanest sense how our proof must be a deduction in science and in pure reasoning. And so she says, an evidence of the senses can never give us a proof. She says, there is not so much evidence to prove intercommunication between the so-called dead and the living as there is to show the sick that matter suffers and has sensation. See, she says, there is more proof of spiritualism in every pain and sickness. Because in every pain and sickness we say, well, I feel pain, I suffer, my body suffers, and thereby acknowledging that there is life in matter, that there is pain in matter, that there is anything in matter. Whereas, and that is no proof of its immortality. Just because there is an evidence to the senses, that does not prove a pain to be real. Because just because there is evidence to the physical senses, this is no proof whatsoever about it. Our proof always must lie in a pure deduction from principle. And so she says, well, but mind science, the latter evidence is destroyed by mind science. Mind science can destroy that belief that we suffer in the body and are sick in the body. And just in the same way, we must see that an evidence, a physical sense evidence, because, say, in a spiritualistic seance, a departed reappears and speaks and signs something in his own handwriting and so on, that's not a proof of immortality. On the contrary, it's a proof of its mortality. It's a proof that he has not advanced very much, that he has still two legs and two arms, that he still writes in the same writing, and as this Dr. Rush here in the spiritual seances showed, that he has forgotten how to spell galvanism and said valganism, and so is very forgetting, you see. Just as somebody told me, that in the spiritual seances a spirit came through who said that she was a reader of Ninth Church in London, and when she was asked in which year, she said in 1915. Well, Ninth Church didn't exist at that time. They forget things, you know. But why shouldn't they forget things? We forget a lot. I don't know what I did in 1916. I couldn't tell. I forget it. Just as any other old mortal belief forgets it. What appears is always a mortal belief. Mortal belief made conscious, brought out from the subconscious to the conscious, just as every psychologist can tell us about it. So why look for them for truth, for reason, for science, for proof of God? Spirits hardly ever talk about God. They only talk about mundane things. The other day, when I actually was preparing for these talks, I was asking around a little bit, you know. I asked somebody, an elderly lady lately, did you have any contact with spiritualism? And she said, oh no, because when I was young I had a niece, and that niece lived together with her mother, and that mother died. And so in her desperation, she also went to a spiritualistic seance and asked to get into communication with her mother. And she did, and she said, and all they were conversing about for hours were about cooking and eating. And so she said, that put me off forever from spiritualism. And she said, of course, both were always interested as long as they were together in cooking and eating, which only shows that a mortal belief becomes a conviction and becomes tangible, and mortal belief is all that is reproduced, never an immortal spirit. An immortal spirit is immortal and is spirit, but not a spirit. And an immortal is never in contact with its opposite, can never mingle. That's why the first part is so necessary, you see. The first part has shown us that opposites don't mingle. It's our belief in the mingling of opposite which builds up spiritualism. As long as we have that belief that opposites can mingle, we certainly have communication from so-called spirits, because it's only our own belief in mingling that produces these communications. So this fifth, third part is really very fine, you see. It says that in science, man's immortality depends upon that of God. Why shouldn't people ask spirits and wizards that keep and that matter? Why should not the people seek unto their God? See, that's always the recurring theme which we should keep in mind. Why not whatever happens? Why not when whatever the testimony of the physical senses may be? Be it communication from so-called spirit, be it communications from the boss, be it the communication from the neighbor, be it the communication from a dear friend which is hurting, be it the communication from the body which says, I pain you, be it the communication from some fear which says, you are going to die slowly, slowly but surely. Whatever the communication may be, there are no proofs of their reality. Let's go to God. Why should not the people seek unto their God?